Last week, we told you that Tommy Thompson, the Republican presidential hopeful, had rescheduled and would join us today because of a mix-up by his campaign. He's not with us. We'll try to reschedule that conversation for another day if we can. Meanwhile, we hope to bring you conversations with as many of the presidential candidates as possible in the lead-up to the 2008 election. For 4 years now, the Darfur region of Western Sudan has faced relentless conflict. A peace deal was signed last year, but fighting later continued between rebels and militias who are suspected to have the backing of the Sudanese government. Hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed, millions more displaced. It's been difficult for journalists to gain access to Darfur for much reporting, but NPR's East Africa correspondent Gwen Tompkins was there recently. She was also in Somalia to report on the very different war going on there. She joins us today here in Studio 3A. She's on a visit back home. Nice to see you, Gwen.
Nice to see you, Neil.
And if you have questions for Gwen Tompkins about her reporting trip to Darfur, the conditions in refugee camps, or about Somalia, give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. There's also a conversation going on in our blog, npr.org/blogofthenation. Gwen, how did you manage to get into Darfur?
Well, you're right. It's not easy to get into Darfur, particularly if you're a reporter, and particularly if you're an American reporter. But I lucked out, actually. The World Food Program has a new executive director, Josette Shireen, and she spent many years here in Washington. And she's a fan of NPR. That's mm-hmm. really what it came down to. She was a fan of NPR, and she made it her business to make sure that there was an NPR reporter who was able to accompany her on her first trip, which was our trip to East Africa. So she went to Ethiopia, she went to Sudan as well, and I think also to Chad. Mm-hmm. So, without her, I don't know. I think I would still be standing at the Sudanese embassy in Nairobi saying, please, 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 give me a visa.
But it must have been fascinating not only to obviously see the thing through your own eyes, but to see them through hers as well.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, she had never been there before.
Yeah.
And so we were very much the same, in heading over there. And, the World Food Program is, the largest humanitarian aid organization in the world. Sudan is its biggest program, and Darfur is the lion's share of that program. And so she was very eager to get over there. We've heard so much about Darfur as Americans. As any followers of the news, we've heard about it. And so, you are always, you try not to go in with preconceived notions, but you do. And then when you get there, you're like, oh, okay, so this is Darfur.
Yeah.
This is what it looks like. And it is just one of the most remote areas I've ever visited in the world.
And even just looking at a map, which is all I've done, huge.
Huge, yes. Yes, it is huge. And it is, Sudan is the largest country in Africa. It's got 9 international borders. Darfur has 3 international borders, So, you can imagine how big this region is. And it is the part that we visited, which is around El Fasher, which is a regional capital. It is desert. There is a problem with desertification in this region, and desertification is winning, okay? And so essentially what you see is just miles after miles after miles of sand. You see, even the mountains are crumbling into sand, before your very eyes. And the structures where people live are sort of adobe-style structures, in which there are tents or other types of buildings, behind sort of these adobe walls. They don't look so bad. You're thinking, I see something like this in maybe Arizona, not a full-time dwelling for somebody, but I've certainly seen adobe-style architecture and sort of, but then you sort of look around, you're standing there, and you realize, we are alone. We are completely alone in this encampment, in this region, where you could stand on the side of a house and scream as loud as you possibly can scream, and no one will hear you, And so that's when it really comes home to you that anything could happen at any time, and no one would know about it.
Is that what you meant? You once used the expression, this is like the Wild West.
Well, yes. I've used that expression particularly with regard to southern Sudan, which is a whole sort of different story, because it's kind of like a boom town, a booming area. This area is, it's kind of, it's quiet. and it's strangely quiet, and it's unnaturally quiet. And so one of the impressions that I took away from there in meeting some of the people who lived there is just the effect of being alone in, in the desert, and living in a situation in which very few people from the outside come to visit you, and there are very few, methods of communication to actually communicate with the outside world. So, it's almost as if you're on an island, by mm-hmm. yourself in that region.
And is that, at least in part, because some of the people who live there have been driven away or have been killed?
Well, I think it's in part just the geography and the topography of the area. And then also, people have been driven into camps, into mm-hmm. these huge camps for internally displaced people, some as large as, 56,000 people, some smaller ones that are maybe 24,000, but that's still an awful lot of people. And so these are people who see maybe aid workers every day who do a heroic job, but that's all they see, And just think about it. In the course of your day or my day, we meet all sorts of people. We see all sorts of people. Just if you go and buy a cup of coffee, you're dealing with somebody mm-hmm. you've never seen before, you make a telephone call, you call information, you're talking to somebody to get a phone number. I mean, you're talking to people you don't know. Mm-hmm. And in this region, there is none of that. So, the children are starved for attention, the adults are starved for attention, and you just feel as if, you're just one, sort of person, but you do feel as if you're doing some small teeny service just by listening to people whose voices have not been heard.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. Again, we're talking with Gwen Tompkins, NPR's East Africa correspondent, who's home on a short visit. And let's begin with Fred. Fred with us from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
I've dealt with refugees from all over the world for about the last 30 years. Most recently, again, from Africa. One parallel seems to be running, and it's troubling with me for U.S. policy, and that is the influence of China and, to some extent, Russia, but in the Sudan, China, and why we appear to have chosen cheap underwear and Happy Meals and trade with China rather than holding them accountable for the evil that they're doing. And we passed these disinvestment from Sudan legislation, like in the Indiana legislature, but we do nothing to hold China, Thailand, India accountable for the tragedy that's probably almost equal in Burma. And finally, why are the news media not covering what the United States military is doing in Somalia under the guise of chasing terrorists?
Well, there are a lot of questions there. Let's begin, Fred. We should inform people. China, of course, a member of the United Nations Security Council with a veto there. And there has been been openly reported that the reason the United States has not pushed for legislation for Security Council resolutions there to punish the Sudanese government is for fear of a Chinese veto. And for whatever reason, they've not forced China to make a veto. How do you see that on the ground in Sudan, Gwen?
Well, that's a good question. The thing is, there's a scramble going on for Africa. There was a scramble for Africa in the 19th century, and there's a scramble for Africa right now going on with regard to its resources. And oil is the driving resource that that is motivating China and motivating other countries to have interest in Sudan and to contribute in some part to the development of Sudan. That being said, I have not done a whole lot of reporting on this topic, in large part because it's very difficult to get into Sudan. In the parts where I have visited, I have seen some work being done by Chinese workers who are helping to build some of the infrastructure of southern Sudan, for instance, and maybe some other parts of northern Sudan. The thing is, and I'm not in any way trying to speak as an apologist for China or any other country, but I was talking the other day to the foreign minister of Sudan in Khartoum, and we're talking about sanctions, and I said, well, what effect would sanctions have on on Sudan? And he said, the underlying problem of not only of every region of Sudan is that there's a lack of development. And and development in large part will help to remedy some of the economic and political chasms that are existing.
The underlying factors.
Exactly, in Sudan. So he, of course, made a very, sort of passionate argument against sanctions, in large part because he said, if you starve Sudan, you're just going to make every situation, every region even poorer. And Lord knows in Darfur, where people are fighting over very scant resources, the prospect of fighting over even less than that is frightening.
Of course, the other side of the argument is, how do you tolerate what the U.S. State Department calls genocide?
Absolutely. That's the truth. But you have to also remember, this is not, it's not, this is a part of the world where in southern Sudan, for instance, there is one paved road. There is 10 miles of tarmac in all of southern Sudan. And John Garang, who was the former leader of the Sudanese People's Liberation Army, he used to say there has been no tarmac in southern Sudan since creation.
What about Fred's other question? And that's the other war you've been reporting on. That's in Somalia, where Ethiopian troops supported by the United States. He says the activities of U.S. special forces involved in that fighting.
Well, that's a tough story. It's an excellent story. It's a story that I think we're going to see a lot more from in the coming months. It's so far for a lot of reporters who are outside of Somalia right now, and most reporters are, it's a difficult story to get to, in large part because it's such a difficult region. It's such a difficult area of the country. Of the continent. It's so dangerous. My sources in Somalia are telling me this is the worst I've seen it in 15 years. This is not the time to come. Mm-hmm. And so when you are removed physically from a region and unable to cover it, as we've been in Somalia because of the violence, as we've been in Sudan for other reasons, then the world is very slow to wake up to a lot of what's going on in these areas.
Fred, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
We're talking with Gwen Tompkins, NPR's East Africa correspondent. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we have from Skip in Little Rock, Arkansas. I lived in Eritrea many years ago when it was part of Ethiopia and have always been very fond of both countries and peoples and very saddened by the near constant hostilities between the two. With Ethiopia's heavy involvement in Somalia, Eritrea must certainly be playing its role as a spoiler. And I've heard recently that hostilities on the border between Eritrea and Ethiopia are heating up again. Do you have any new information on either front?
Well, I'm glad that you got that email. The thing is, This is, I think, one of the most interesting stories in East Africa, this border conflict between Eritrea and Ethiopia, which has gone on for so long, which it continues to drag on. And many have seen the difficulties in Somalia as a proxy war between Eritrea and Ethiopia. As you know, it was Ethiopian military force that really won the war, so to speak, against the Islamic Courts Union, who were in control of Mogadishu for so long last year. And part of Ethiopia's reasoning for going in was that they said that there were Eritrean forces who were on the ground in Somalia who were in support of the Islamic Courts Union. And this is turning into a huge mess. This border conflict is resulting in hotspots being created or being exacerbated in other areas of the region. And just recently, Eritrea, withdrew from a major, sort of regional African diplomatic and peacekeeping entity, in large part because it was very dissatisfied with the lack of support it felt from that organization vis-a-vis Ethiopia.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seems as if this situation it has to be dealt with before you're really going to see any kind of lasting peace in other areas of the region.
Okay, let's see if we can get to one last caller on the line, and we'll go to Nick. Nick with us from Kansas City.
Hello.
Hi.
Thank you very much for taking the call.
Sure.
I have two questions.
We may only have time for one, but go ahead, please.
Okay. Give us your best one.
I had understood from work at the State Department that a large number of the people in Darfur were actually recent immigrants in the last 20 to 40 years from Chad and Uganda. And I'm wondering if that is correct, or what do you see as the history of this conflict?
I should have asked you to give us your easiest question.
The question is that we also hear of...
Well, Why don't we do our best to attack that one?
No, I'm teasing. The thing is, you know, there are, the borders in Africa, and particularly the borders in East Africa, are sort of synthetic borders that were created by colonial powers that divided, you know, the same groups of people, you know, one group of people into two different nations. And so there are an awful lot of, there are an awful lot of the same ethnic groups, you know what I mean, on either side of the border between Sudan and Chad, or, you know what I mean, between Sudan and Uganda, and even Sudan and Congo. So I think that your source over at the State Department is actually right. I mean, there's a lot of commonality that's going on here, and it's very difficult to sort of tease out where people's loyalties lie. I mean, traditionally, your loyalty is to your family, to your clan, to your ethnic group, and then it's to your country. You know what I mean? The country is almost it's like the last in line. And so that is in large part what's feeding a lot of the chaos that you're reading about. Hmm.
Gwen, we just have a few seconds left. Are you having a good time?
Well, most days, yes, most days. I mean, it's, this is a region of the world that is constantly changing and constantly, surprising you. And you just don't know what the heck's going on half the time. And then when you do finally figure it out, then you start questioning yourself, like, well, maybe this is not really, it's just sort of a shell game. You know, you just never quite know whether you've got the story, whether you've got the truth. And then you start wondering, well, what is true? What is true?
Yeah. That's a friend of mine in Belfast. I talked to him once, and he said, "I'm confused." He says, "Oh, lad, if you're not confused, you don't know what's going on."
Exactly.
Gwen Tompkins, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you, Neil.
Gwen Tompkins is NPR's East Africa correspondent here on a short visit back home. She joined us today in Studio 3A. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.